Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the Jerome L. Green Performance Space, our ground floor theater today. And remember, listeners, you can also watch the show when we're in the green space. We have a live video stream of today's show going, and you can find that on WNYC's Facebook page, on the Green Space's Facebook page, or at thegreenspace.org. And remember, there's an E at the end of green if you're going to the Green Space. .org. Little bit of Trump-related breaking news. After our conversation with Ian Bremmer, the Senate Judiciary Committee has just announced that it is subpoenaing Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign manager, to testify in the Russia investigation. And I guess what that means is that they couldn't come to a voluntary agreement with Manafort to testify, because they did seem to be working on one last week. So interesting that the Senate Judiciary Committee felt that it needed to subpoena Manafort, and I am told that that testimony will take place tomorrow. So I guess we will have something to talk about tomorrow morning. We're not going to run out of news. With me now is Susan Chira, senior correspondent for the New York Times and their editor on gender issues. Susan has a new crowdsourcing project designed to measure if sexism in America has gotten worse since the election of Donald Trump. Audience here in the green space, as you know, we emailed you the write-up for the project. We also tweeted it to our Twitter followers. And for the rest of you listening on air, Susan writes that she's been hearing from a wide range of women who say they feel like there is less shame about sexist language or attitudes, and that men feel emboldened to make sexist remarks and to dismiss objections to those remarks as political correctness. So she is collecting anecdotes. She wants concrete anecdotes, not just impressions, of anything like this that you yourself have encountered. So if anyone has a story like that, we invite you to call in at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Folks here in the green space, you can just raise your hands. And we'll talk to Susan a little bit first, but just let me get a sense. Did anybody here in the green space come with an anecdote like that after receiving that email? I see a couple of hands. I see one hand here, so we'll get to you. And hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC, and welcome to the Green Space.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
What made you decide to collect stories of sexism since the election?
Well, actually, I was prompted by the fact that a lot of people have said to me spontaneously during interviews or in conversation that they had this feeling that it was a little bit more of an open season for misogyny. I mean, I had people write me and say, there's a story here. And you know, as a journalist, you can't really go on impression. And I would say, well, that's interesting. Can I talk to specific people? Can we hear about a specific example? And can we understand that it was qualitatively different than before the election? This is still a challenge. I haven't, you know, nailed this down journalistically. So we're in an ongoing conversation. And I'm not trying to go on a political fishing expedition. This is, for me, not about pro or anti Donald Trump. What it's about is an impression that a number of women have said to me. I've been doing reporting on a whole range of different articles, and people have spontaneously said to me, you know, this is different, or I feel that I was in a meeting the other day and someone was freer to say something obnoxious, or so on. So I said, let me at least throw it open, see what people come up with, and weigh it.
I'll give you one that I've told on the air before.
Okay.
And I'll tell it again just to kind of model an example that
sure
might fit your bill. And maybe you'll is an impression and not really a story, or I don't know, you'll tell me. But I was listening to one of the sports talk stations one mm-hmm. day, shortly after the actress Florence Henderson had died. Mm. And a caller was on with the host talking about sports. And then the caller added, I just also want to say that I'll miss Florence Henderson. I loved her in the Brady Bunch. And the host said, yeah, and she was also a really attractive broad. Then he seemed to catch himself on the word broad and said, oh, I guess I shouldn't say that. And here's the punchline. The caller said, it's okay, we're in the Trump era now. And it was sort of a joke, but it also revealed that some guy calling a sports talk show was already thinking, like what you're writing about, like sexist language is more okay now because Trump got elected.
And I would say that, at least for me, my interest in sexist language is one, but I think it's also a sense that some people have said that it's not just about forbidden words, you know, like chick or broad or whatever we who grew up in a certain era began to feel was language that was off limits. It's really a sense that are there ways in which there's enormous resentment about the progress that women has made that's now being expressed more openly, or that people feel perhaps that they can say, I don't like this, and we don't need to have women represented in the upper tiers of this or that, or as more women in power. And I think, you know, one example I at least have been thinking about that's been very much in the news lately has been the way that the three women who senators who have been opposing the repeal and replace for various, three of whom are Republicans, Lisa Murkowski, Shelley Moore Capito, and of course Susan Collins, the kind of criticism that they've come in for has been very, very almost extraordinarily outlandish. In terms like Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, said, well, if you don't, you know, if they don't like it, you could just vacuum out, maybe. I mean, there are all kinds of very vivid, and a Texas legislator just said he would challenge these women to a duel if they were men. This kind of language, this kind of almost quasi-violent imagery is something that I'm also interested in exploring to see if that somehow seems more permissible.
Along those lines, I read your piece last month in the Times called Who Likes Trump's Tweets and Why? And that was specifically hooked to the ecstatic response, you used the word ecstatic, that he gets in some quarters when he tweets insults seen as sexist. You wrote this after he tweeted about Mika Brzezinski bleeding badly from a facelift, as he put it. So, ecstatically?
Yeah, I guess what I was thinking about is that we'd done a lot of, you know, outrage about sexist tweet A, B, or C from the president or other people. And I was more interested in, why does this keep happening? It obviously appeals, it's a dog whistle to the base. And so I was interested in why, and I went in onto Twitter and I was looking at a lot of the response, which I could describe as ecstatic from a certain segment. Now look, of course social media amplifies and possibly exaggerates, you know, a particular cohort who feel emboldened sometimes because there's anonymity. So I want to be careful as a journalist, but I would say that what I was trying to examine in that dispatch was, why does it work? Why is it striking a resonant chord? And to me, that's a really interesting question that I am just beginning to explore, honestly, and I don't feel I have simple answers. But that kind of response, like, go get her, really interesting to me.
Let's go to one of our audience members here in the green space who raised her hand with, I guess, a story along these lines that fits Susan Chira's invitation. Hi there.
Hello. Thank you, and I'm glad you're working on this.
Thank you.
I actually have two. Each is very quick. I was on the subway, I would say maybe a month ago, and a woman with a very squirmy toddler in her lap and an infant strapped to her back was not offered a seat by a man sitting near us. I came in, I have gray hair, and she said to this guy, well, if you're not offering one to me, how about offering one to her? Mm. And he said, yeah, talk to me after the next election.
Mm. That's interesting. Yeah, very explicit in that case. Yeah.
The other one actually happened to me this morning, and I'm still a little shaky about it, to tell you the truth. I was listening to a podcast that was summarizing Betsy DeVos's meeting regarding mm-hmm. men and their feeling about being falsely implicated in sexual assault cases. And as I listened to this, I started remembering every sexual assault I've had, I think, you know, mm-hmm. two or three or four, I don't know. And I did not have that reaction when the Access Hollywood tapes came out. And I'll say one of these happened when I was a toddler and one when I was in college. And what I was hearing Betsy DeVos do was blowing a whistle to the male base. I mean, this is basically another, I heard it as another way, a little more dressed up, of saying, yeah, these women, you know, always complaining about this.
Make it up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or boys will be boys, or, you know, whatever that translates into.
I see.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for, you know, sharing your experience with us. I really appreciate your courage in that.
Let's go to one from a caller. Line two, this is Sue in Manhattan. Sue, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. The day after the election, the morning after the election, I was on my way to the new school on 16th Street, and I was walking between 6th Avenue and 5th Avenue on the south side of 16th Street. Now, that street at about 9:30 in the morning is completely empty. Occasionally, someone's walking by, but maybe five or six people could walk abreast easily without bumping into each other. A white man in about his 50s, was walking towards me, and there was plenty of room. And as he got towards me, he veered into me and banged into me and said, "Welcome to the Trump era."
Wow, that's pretty concrete, too.
I guess so. Sue, how did you feel after that?
I'm shaking now to repeat it, and it was, you know, 7-8 months ago, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing
it
with us.
Thank you for coming forward.
Totally, it was really gratuitous violence. And I'm in my 60s, you know. There was just no way for him to have to do this.
And the person made that comment.
He said, "Welcome to the Trump era."
Sue, thank you very much. You know, Susan, one of my producers suggested there might be a kind of opposite corollary to this pattern, too, that men's feeling of greater freedom to say sexist things and do sexist things is out there, but also that women are so enraged by Trump that, you know, and this whole trend, that they feel more emboldened to push back. And so maybe there's more talking back to men who say sexist things, or more formal complaints of sexual harassment being lodged with HR departments and things like that. Maybe that's a whole separate crowdsourcing project.
Yeah. I actually think it's a really important, I didn't mean to step on your question. I think it's a really important point. I mean, of course, as we know, women are not, you know, undifferentiated. And there were plenty of women who supported Donald Trump and continue to support Donald Trump. And in my reporting, I've talked to a lot of them. But I would say that at the same time, the segment of women who are outraged by either his policies or his statements have, you know, look at the Women's March and look at all the follow-ups to the Women's March, the sustained protests that have been organized, particularly around the rollback of ACA, which has been really spearheaded by Planned Parenthood and a lot of women's groups that very much aided by women who feel that health care benefits that they rely on are in jeopardy. And of course, the whole segment of concerns about abortion rights and the importance of the Supreme Court. So I think you have also seen, you know, a sense that, okay, if this is going on, those segment of women who oppose these policies really want to make their voices heard and have been completely out there about doing so. So I think that point is exactly right.
Let's take another person here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi. My name is Millie. I live on the West Side, and I'm in my 60s, and I did your homework last night, or our homework last night, Brian, and I read your piece, Susan, and I was trying to think of something in particular since the Trump era. And for me, I've been aware of this my entire life as a woman, being born in the 1950s, and I still deal with it with people in my family. And I think a lot of women of my generation who live with men who were born in that generation, or who have relatives or friends in that generation, it never stopped. It's been a battle ever since. And I think I have a 26-year-old daughter. She doesn't face the same things because her male friends just didn't grow up with that. And Trump is the perfect example when he's a 70-year-old man. So there are tons of other 70-year-old men out there and 60-year-old men and 50, even in their 50s or 60s that just have not become, they haven't progressed. Some men have progressed, and that's great. And we're, you know, right now we're in the most progressive place in the United States. But most men of that era, I believe, and even many of them here, and many of them of a certain culture and background and a certain age, they're just always been like that. And yeah. I've been fighting for women's rights since the 60s. So anyway, that's pretty much my comment.
Thank you. So, Susan, how much do you see this in generational terms?
I think that the generational point's a really important one. I mean, it's true that Donald Trump, as a 70-year-old man, you know, came of age in a time when, you know, the women's movement was just beginning to gain steam, and he grew up without, you know, some of these ideas in the air, or at least these ideas being very embattled. I think that the generational point is important, and that's one reason why I'm not starting out on this exploration with a preconceived conclusion. I want actually to understand, and I do think there's an important point that, you know, sexism is hardly a new thing. It wasn't invented in the last 8 months. Heaven knows. But I'm also interested in the kinds of experiences that in which, I mean, at least I think you could make an argument that over time, some of the attitudes that were common in the, say, Mad Men era, if we think of the TV show, which certainly parallels my own childhood, you know, became seen as attitudes that you shouldn't have or you shouldn't admit to. So I think it's partly a question of what the norms are and how they're being expressed.
If you're just joining us, it's The Brian Lehrer Show, live from the Green Space today. My guest right now is New York Times gender issues editor Susan Chira, who has launched a new crowdsourcing project for women to tell concrete stories. And you can submit it, I guess, if you have a story,
yes,
on the Times website.
Please, please feel free to email me at chira@nytimes.com.
C-H-I-R-A.
C-H-I-R-A. And I would invite anyone who would like these stories to be collected, if they're willing to put their first and last names to it, please let me know. Because I'd much rather name names if people are comfortable, because that enhances credibility.
Stories of sexism being worse or different since the election of Donald Trump. Let's take another question from here in the green space, and this is another of the high school journalism students from the Bronx. Hi there.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Garrett Murphy from Manhattan. I do remember just after Trump got elected, my English teacher told us all about how she was walking to the school one day, and this man in a truck almost like ran her over. It was very, and he screamed, "Yeah, she is Asian," and the man stepped out and said, "This is America," and she responded with, "And this is a crosswalk."
The presence of mind.
Very
thick. Even
she was very
being,
quick-witted while being in physical danger.
Yeah, really. You quote a researcher who places this mostly among non-college educated men. We talked about generation. There's also class. One of your sources saw this in class terms. Where do you think class comes into it?
Right. Well, I talked to a very interesting woman named Joan Williams, who is a professor at law, who's written a really provocative book about how class is the last remaining okay prejudice in American society. And her argument is that, you know, elites such as those who live in New York City often look down on and are contemptuous of class, and that in some ways, some of what we're seeing in the Trump era, this is not confined to gender in her mind, but gender plays a role, is a kind of, look, you're trying to tell me how to think, how to live. You're trying to tell me that I don't have a right to my opinions. The hell with you, I'm finally being represented. And so I think class plays a role, but honestly, I don't think these attitudes are confined to class. I think they span class.
And if we talk about class, don't we see from so much about Trump supporters and detractors that race trumps class at almost every turn? The kind of white male who feels emboldened by Trump also feels their place in the economy is being usurped by blacks and Latinos rather than looking to Wall Street or something like that, while black and Latino working class men more look to the power structure?
I think that's an apt observation. I think, you know, as we all know, it's really hard to separate any of this. There's race, there's class, there's gender. You know, all these things interact. And I think that you can make a case that for some men, their fear has been that the economy, that women are competing with them for jobs, even in, you know, manufacturing to some degree, but even more in the growing sectors of the economy, which are often pink-collar so-called jobs that are dominated by women, healthcare, administrative, so that there's economic competition, which sharpens that sense of losing your place in society and losing your place in the economy.
And that the so-called liberal establishment goes out of its way to structurally advantage women and people of color.
That's right, at the expense of them. I think this sense that, you know, you win, I lose, instead of we all win.
And you've also written really interestingly after the election about how, with the majority of white women voting for Trump, being a woman is not necessarily a liberal cause in and of itself.
I think it's really important to make that point. And in my reporting, I've tried very hard. You know, being a woman doesn't mean you're automatically liberal. And when I talk to women at some length who voted for Donald Trump, like most human beings, I mean, as a journalist, you try to see people whole and not in caricatures. And they were very complex. And a number of them led lives that I would call liberated. They were working. They cared about a number of issues that would be in common with many New Yorkers, but they placed their thumb on the scale in a different way. They voted for him often for economic reasons, for a sense that he would bring back, for economic and safety reasons. And even if some of them didn't like his comments about women, they didn't rank that at the top of their voting preference. And it's just more complex. I don't like to make assumptions that, you know, gender or race will determine politics.
Let's go to line 10, Jarell in Manhattan. Hi, Jarell. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thank you. Yes, you know, what I've noticed is men in this country seem to have a open season on noticing and commenting on the looks of women, and particularly Angela Merkel, who is the leader of Europe's strongest economy, you know, is dissed because of her look. And on the other end of the spectrum, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, we get the same thing from men. I have heard this numerous times. You know what? Rather than, you know, what they're saying. And I'm really disturbed by this, and it seems to have changed since Trump got elected.
That's an interesting observation. I mean, I can't say, I'm not sure what the audience thinks, but I would say one thing. It seems to me that something that is not changed is that when women are attacked, they're attacked for their appearance. I wrote a piece that a lot of my readers hated, which made the point that the way that Hillary Clinton was criticized for appearance, so in fact was Kellyanne Conway, with some of the very same Twitter memes. And a lot of people didn't like that I wrote that, but my feeling is that I'll call out sexism where I see it. It's a bipartisan exercise.
Did you see that Trump was back in Clinton is a witch mode in his tweets this morning?
Yeah,
for those who haven't seen
Go
it,
ahead.
He was ripping Jeff Sessions and the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, for not investigating Hillary's crimes.
Right.
Brought that up here on July 20, whatever it is.
That's right.
We were talking with our previous guest about the Trump and Putin meetings at the G20 summit. And you also wrote an article before the summit that previewed it as a testosterone-fueled face-off. I guess it's obvious why we'd look for that. You know, look at the weird history of handshakes already between Trump and French President Macron.
Right,
but
right.
I wonder if you think it turned out that way.
Yes, you know, it's interesting. It's true. I was trying to look at previous sort of mano-a-mano face-offs like Khrushchev, you know, Kennedy and so on, and Khrushchev Nixon. I actually think that it didn't entirely turn out that way. And that what happened was, rather than becoming, you know, who's going to posture and be stronger, it was like, who's going to fall over each other more in showing affection. And as I sort of thought, it at least appears objectively that Putin had the upper hand. And I sort of assumed that going in, and it's so it seems to be.
Let's go to line 4. Ellen in South Orange, you're on WNYC with Susan Chira. Hi.
Hi. What I wanted to say is that I'm glad in a certain way that these things are now out in the open, because I think that these kinds of attitudes have existed for a really long time. But when they're below the surface and not talked about, we can't have a conversation about them, because the people who hold these views just deny that they exist. And when they're finally making these comments and these actions that they're doing, even though it's horrible for the people that it's happening to, at least we now can have the conversation.
So, Ellen, do you think that things are not really noticeably worse now after the election? It's just kind of more out in the open, what was always there?
I think it gave people license to say what was underneath. Mm-hmm. I don't think it made them suddenly have different attitudes. It just made it okay for them to say it.
Thank you, Susan.
That's very helpful. And I also, that's kind of what I was trying to get at, whether that's the case. I mean, I completely agree. These attitudes don't just spring forth or caused by an election. But I also think you're making a really interesting point about how we confront it. I think when you look at elements of resistance that have sprung up, to use the word, you know, I think that, yes, you know, often it's very painful, but when you get attitudes out in the open, at least you can discuss them. And I do believe that there is some worth in saying, okay, where are we? I mean, part of what I'm trying to do in my report is let's surface it, let's talk about it, let's bring it into the light, because it's scary when it's not in the light. It's also scary, of course, when it is in the light, but I think you're making a really important point to consider.
We're out of time, except that I want you to say one more time how people can contribute to your reporting project.
Please email me at chira@nytimes.com, chira@nytimes.com. Thanks so much for listening.
Susan Chira, senior correspondent and gender issues editor for the New York Times.
Thanks so much, Brian.